From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Last week, the Taliban, the Islamic militants ruling Afghanistan, issued a decree to destroy all pre-Islamic religious images in that country. Two towering 7th century Buddhas topped their list. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thomas Gutierrez about the Taliban's campaign against religious icons and about conditions in Afghanistan. Gutierrez is director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Omaha. Also, a profile of the legendary guerrilla leader heading the war against the Taliban. We talk with journalist Sebastian Junger about Ahmad Shah Massoud, known as the Lion of Panjshir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Moderate Republican lawmakers joined Democratic colleagues today in calling for a trigger mechanism that would keep tax cuts from moving forward if projected surpluses fail to materialize. More from NPR's David Wilna at the Capitol.
It was a rare display of bipartisan resolve as four senators and four representatives from both parties joined together to call for a trigger. With a closely divided Congress, these lawmakers could be pivotal in the fate of President Bush's proposed tax cuts. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle said he applauded the bipartisan group, but warned the trigger was of limited use.
What if the projections are wrong? What if the weather forecast is as bad as the one we got last weekend? It still doesn't deal with the size issue. And it doesn't deal with the fairness and the problems with regard to distribution.
The House, meanwhile, is expected to approve Thursday a major portion of the tax cuts, nearly $1 trillion worth of cuts in across-the-board tax rates. David Wilna, NPR News, the Capitol.
The arraignment of Charles Andy Williams has been postponed for 2 weeks, pending a decision on whether the 15-year-old can be tried as an adult for the killings of two fellow students at his high school. Prosecutors charged Williams with 2 counts of murder and 26 other charges stemming from Monday's shooting at Santana High School in Santee. Williams is accused of wounding 13 other people at the school near San Diego. Meanwhile, police in Southern California arrested two more teenagers today after they allegedly threatened shootings at their school in 29 Palms. Investigators say they found weapons and a list of people who were allegedly to be targeted in the attack. New research finds that cells from aborted fetuses offer little benefit to people with Parkinson's disease. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
Several studies have suggested that patients with Parkinson's disease get better after receiving nerve cells transplanted from human fetuses. Symptoms such as tremor and stiffness appear to decrease. But those studies weren't conclusive because they involved only a small number of patients and did not use a comparison group. The new study, which appears in this week's New England Journal of Medicine, looked at 40 patients with severe Parkinson's disease. Half had surgery to place cells in their brains, and the other half had a similar surgery but got no transplanted cells. Researchers found that people younger than 60 who got transplants did only slightly better than people who didn't, and in older patients there was no difference. The results are likely to renew debate over the value of using aborted fetuses for medical research. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 138 points, or 1.3%. It closed at 10,729 in active trading of more than a billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 19 points to close at 2,224. This is NPR News. Union mechanics at United Airlines and U.S. Airways say they oppose plans to merge the two companies. The union issued a statement saying it's concerned that the $4 billion deal could result in layoffs. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers represents 37,000 workers at the two companies. 25,000 union flight attendants at United have already threatened to strike over the merger. An internet millionaire has bought the Aryan Nation's former compound in northern Idaho for $250,000. The new owner intends to turn the property into an educational center for human rights issues. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Greg Carr, the founder and former chairman of the internet service Prodigy, bought the 20-acre parcel from a mother and son who had gained ownership of it after they won a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against Aryan Nation's founder Richard Butler and his organization. The legal judgment bankrupted the group, forcing the sale of the compound. Carr, an Idaho native, said Butler's church will be turned into a museum, displaying what he called the artifacts of hatred left behind by the Aryan nations. The remaining buildings will be torn down and replaced with a classroom featuring the history and message of the human rights movement. Said Carr, the days of the Aryan nations using this facility as a national headquarters for promoting religious and race-based hatred and violence are over. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan urged bankers today not to tighten credit too much as the economy slows down. In a speech to a bankers group, Greenspan said it wasn't surprising that banks are tightening their lending requirements, but he said they shouldn't overdo it. The Fed chairman didn't mention anything about prospects for interest rates. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Last week, officials of the Taliban, the ruling government of Afghanistan, issued a decree to demolish all pre-Islamic statues that represent the human form. The Taliban reportedly began destroying ancient sacred art last Friday. Among their targets were two immense statues of Buddha carved into the side of a sandstone cliff some 1,400 years ago in Bamyan. Protest has rained down on the Taliban in the past week from all sides, including from other Islamic nations. I spoke yesterday with Thomas Gutierrez about the complicated political situation in Afghanistan. Gutierrez is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. He lived in Afghanistan from 1964 to 1974 and has been back many times to do research for his center and for the United Nations. He's visited the Buddhist statues at Bamyan many times.
Well, actually, I've always considered two places my favorite places in the whole world. One, Tiger Stadium, my favorite baseball team used to play there, in Bamyan in Afghanistan. And in Bamyan in Afghanistan, this is an incredibly beautiful, pristine valley at around 9,000 feet. And here was a fertile valley with a stream running through the whole expanse of it. And on either side, major bluffs that were really eroded into cliffs. And into the cliffs on the northern side of the valley were carved these Buddhas. I used to love to sit on the bluffs above, on the southern side of the valley, and just look across this incredible valley where people are working down below, farming, harvesting, running through the town, and maybe about 4 or 5 football fields length away from where I was sitting was where these Buddhas were located. So there was this incredibly, beautiful work of art in these across the way. And then there was man down below, living and working and going about his lifestyle, much in the same way that man was going about working and his lifestyle during the period when these Buddhas were constructed. In the face of this cliff, which these two Buddhas, these very large statues, were flanking, were a series people have described as some 5 kilometers of caves that were very ornate, very deeply carved into the sandstone cliffs, that were kind of gathering halls, eating halls, dormitories for the Buddhist monks and others who would be staying at this particular religious site or a monastery, perhaps. But for me, it was always my favorite place because I had spent 10 years in Afghanistan, and it was a spot of uncommon calm and charm and beauty.
I believe this site has already been compromised by war. Resistance guerrilla fighters have been headquartered in these caves in Bamyan, and there is a rumor that the statues themselves were used at one point for target practice.
Well, I've heard that too, but I can tell you that I was there as late as 1999, and none of that had occurred. And I was very pleased to see that because there had been a lot of fighting in that valley, and it was, of great concern because these really are Afghanistan's greatest treasure. These are the things that people would travel, you know, thousands of miles from around the other side of the world to come to visit because they are so spectacular. They were layered with terracotta, which was, you know, at least 15 centuries old, and they were also within the niche in which they were carved. There were terracotta types of frescoes, and the colors of which were still there because it, unlike the Sistine Chapel, they hadn't had any, you know, reconstructive painting or anything, and it was just remarkable that all of this was there yet to see.
Mullah Muhammad Omar, the Taliban supreme leader, is the main thrust behind the campaign against the statues. What is his justification for the destruction of the art?
Well, of course, there can be no real justification, but his justification, as he believes it is that all forms of humans should be destroyed because that it's improper for Muslims to represent the human form. And this comes out of a decision that the Prophet Muhammad and his followers observed after the beginnings of Islam, in which idols of a of the kind of, one would call them the animistic religions around Mecca and Medina were destroyed by them. But they never declare or suggest that works of art or things of that nature should be included in that particular type of thing. And through the centuries, Muslims have always exhibited a level of tolerance in terms of preserving the art forms of other cultures over which they may have gained sway. And it is, very hard to understand from whence Mullah Omar gains his extreme interpretation.
In news reports, a number of Taliban officials have expressed dismay and disagreement with the mullah's decree to destroy the statuary. How strong is his support even among the Taliban rank and file?
Well, his support, particularly when he came into power in the mid-90s, was quite high because Afghanistan had just gone through a period of nearly 20 years of war. Now it's a period that goes beyond 20 years when you consider the coup that brought in the pro-Soviet government and then the Soviet invasion and then the Soviet-Afghan war, which ended in 1989. And then thereafter, the kind of civil war that was going on in Afghanistan after the fall of the pro-Soviet government, the Mujahideen, who had been waging war to against the Soviet Union, fell amongst themselves to fighting in a kind of warlord situations. And Mullah Omar kind of rose up as a vigilante character, almost a Robin Hood character in the Kandahar area in defense of the rights of individuals who were having their rights violated by this very unfortunate anarchic period which was going on in Afghanistan.
So he was seen as a kind of savior initially,
and I think one of the reasons why the Taliban were so successful moving from community to community to gain, you know, the support of individuals without having even to fight was that people were so tired of the war, so tired of the corruption, so tired of the rape and the pillaging that was going on between the rival groups, the rival warlords, that they saw this Taliban movement, which kind of sprang up from almost nowhere, as a source of, emancipation. And what, you know, most people are not aware of is that this group started out kind of small, but then it grew very rapidly, and it grew rapidly with the support of the Pakistanis, particularly the Pakistani military. And I think what's happened is that since this time, Mullah Omar and his compatriots have been unable to deliver the kinds of things that almost any citizen would expect of a nation state in terms of social services, public works, and generally a style of life in which they are not daily intimidated by some religious whim or another. And so his popularity now, I think, is at an all-time low within the country. But He still has a very substantial Praetorian guard of Pakistanis, Osama bin Laden, and others who are with him, that helps to keep him in power.
There is speculation that the push to destroy Afghanistan's pre-Islamic heritage is in reaction to the United Nations sanctions imposed on Afghanistan in January for not surrendering the Saudi militant leader Osama bin Laden. What do you make of that theory?
I don't agree with it. This is an idea that has been advanced by the Pakistanis first, and it hasn't yet come out from either the Taliban or other Afghans. I think that it helps to serve, again, the basic foreign policy objective that the Pakistanis have in Afghanistan. So they can blame these kinds of actions as a reaction against, some type of Western actions. And, in fact, what we have here is a situation which the Pakistanis themselves are responsible for. In other words, they are, in many ways, the creation of this particular type of what has become a monster, in a sense, in terms of what the people of Afghanistan need. And Mullah Omar has, I think, become kind of obsessed with his own particular belief in him, of him possessing some type of divine right or direct line of communication with God. And I think with that obsession, he has started to lash out and do these kinds of things.
I'm speaking with Thomas Gutierre. He's the Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies there. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Gutierre. He was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan in the mid-60s and 70s, also headed the Fulbright Foundation there. Now he directs the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. I'd like you to talk about the role of the United States in Afghanistan. I think the United States funneled arms, billions of dollars of arms and training for soldiers during the war against the Soviets. And critics of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan argue that after the Soviets pulled out of the nation, the U.S. basically dropped out also, leaving the country armed to the teeth, full of landmines, CIA-trained terrorists, and a civilian population devastated by the war and by famine, and that policy helped lead to the ascent of the Taliban.
Well, I'm one of those critics. I think that the United States really has a moral obligation to help the Afghan people. They did fight what many consider to be the last battle of the Cold War. They encountered tremendous suffering. Many, many, many Afghans were killed. The estimates usually, focus around about 1.5 million people killed, but some estimates are even higher. And then there were other untold millions who spent their lives living as refugees in either Iran or Pakistan or in other countries. And after the fall of the Soviet Union and subsequently the collapse of the pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan, the United States really did not assume the type of profile that was needed to encourage the more moderate traditional elements within Afghanistan as it needed to embark on its reconstruction. I think in a situation like this where you needed a Marshall Plan style of reconstruction, Afghanistan today looks like Dresden after the Second World War. In a situation like that, the United States kind of dropped back. It didn't come forward. And so all of the traditional, moderate, and historically rich elements of Afghanistan upon which a reconstruction should have been built or based had no real allies, and the more extremist Islamist forms within Afghanistan, groups within Afghanistan, had the support within this vacuum of the extremist elements in Pakistan and the Persian Gulf. And that's what has proceeded from our kind of exit of the area.
You lived in Afghanistan from 64 to 74, where you worked. First you worked in the Peace Corps, later you worked for the Fulbright Foundation. What was it like living there then?
Well, here I was, a young fellow from Maumee, Ohio, who had never flown in an airplane or seen any foreign country until I flew to Afghanistan. So I can tell you that the first day or two was quite a dramatic change from anything that I had ever seen. And I found an exceedingly hospitable people, very proud people, and a country so rich in history. People like, you know, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, the Mughals, you know, all of these famous waves of humanity that swept through Asia, you know, all went through Afghanistan, leaving incredible riches in art and traditions and history and great food and a place that one kind of would dream of visiting, you know. And understand that the Afghans were not a rich people. The king of Afghanistan, you know, did not live high off the hog, and neither did any other of the other really major elites compared to the way we live in the West or in Europe or whatever. But they had a rich life. In fact, I took Bill Bradley when he was still an NBA basketball player after he and the Knicks won the championship in 1970. I took him to Bamiyan, and because he wanted to visit Afghanistan and a part of Afghanistan that reflected his favorite story of all time, the man who would be king. Like, I used to coach the Afghan national basketball team, and I also coached the Afghan women's basketball team. And I would get invited, you know, into people's homes to have tea. And so there was a really, I think, wonderful social ambiance in the urban settings. In the rural areas, life went on essentially as it had, but there was an egalitarianism in Afghan society, which now is missing under the Taliban.
How did basketball come to be such a big sport in Afghanistan?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know, but it really was a break for me. I was never a great basketball player, but I loved coaching basketball, and I had done some of that in the United States before I went as a Peace Corps volunteer. And while I was teaching it as a Peace Corps volunteer, teaching English, as many of us did, a group of students came up my second day in country, actually, and said, "Now, we understand you coach basketball." Where they heard that, I don't know. "We need a coach for our team, and please help us out." So I started to coach the team, Habibia Lycée, where I was an English teacher, and my teams did very well. As a result, I was asked then to coach the Afghan national basketball team, which I did for the next 10 years. And the Afghans were great athletes. They are great athletes. They're tremendous, you know, their capacity to run at a high altitude is fantastic, because we were living at 6,000 feet. And they could, you know, learn the jump shot. I even had Bill Bradley teaching them a jump shot when he came to Afghanistan in 1970. Also, you know, how to do the moving hook, and so it was a fantastic opportunity for me to get to meet a lot of young people, to learn things about Afghanistan's culture, to learn a vocabulary that I might not have learned otherwise, and it was you know, I think the competitive spirit of the Afghans was ensured the success of a basketball program. And friends of mine in the Peace Corps and I, we set up leagues in Kabul. We did a similar thing in Herat and in Kandahar by going and setting up clinics. And basketball started to become the most popular kind of sport in Afghanistan, not the most played. Soccer would be that, of course. But it had high attendance because it was the type of thing that everybody could watch. Girls could come and watch it, and as well as the boys, and boys started to come to watch girls' basketball games. It was just a dynamic, athletic, environment.
Do you see an end to the war, and what role would the U.S. play in that?
I don't, unfortunately. I wish I'm known as a kind of incurably optimistic person, but I don't see this coming to an end now. If for example, the Talibs were to gain control of the remaining parts of Afghanistan, controlled now by Ahmad Shah Massoud, I would still think that the war would continue on in some type of guerrilla form. I think it's also possible, if that happened, that within the Taliban movement there might become a splintering that would perhaps project continuing fighting there. I don't see anything really moving towards resolution right now. Everything that is being done by any influential international group is being done to promote the extension and the success of the war. The real input is being made by Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and to some degree Iran and Russia into providing weapons to either sides. And there's nothing really ongoing at this moment to promote the resolution of this war in a peaceful way, to promote any type of confidence building, which, you know, is so sorely needed now. The Afghans had a social fabric that, you know, was constructed over centuries. Those types of social fabrics in multi-ethnic nations are very, very fragile. That fabric has been ripped apart, and to reconstruct it, to tie it, sew it back together, is a monumental task that, you know, nobody has begun, and it will take decades and decades. And so my read of this is not very optimistic, Barbara.
Thomas Gutierrez, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Nice to have been with you.
Thomas Gutierrez is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the guerrilla war against the Taliban. Journalist Sebastian Junger traveled to Afghanistan to profile the legendary resistance leader, General Ahmad Shah Massoud, who also led the fight against the Soviets. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Since the Taliban rose to power in 1994, a resistance movement known as the Northern Alliance has pursued a guerrilla war in pockets throughout Afghanistan. It now controls a small territory in the Northeast Mountains. Their leader is General Ahmad Shah Massoud, a near-legendary figure in the nation, credited with driving out the Soviets in the 1980s. Massoud is an educated warrior. He went to an elite French school in Kabul and received special military training in Pakistan, where many Afghans were groomed to counter the then-looming Soviet invasion. For 5 weeks this past November and December, my guest, Sebastian Junger, shadowed Massoud as he commanded his troops in attacks on Taliban forces. Junger was accompanied by photographer Reza Degati. Into the Forbidden Zone, a National Geographic Explorer documentary about their journey, airs on CNBC this Friday and Saturday. Junger's article about General Massoud appears in the current issue of National Geographic Adventure magazine. I asked Junger if Massoud in person lived up to his mythic reputation.
I mean, it's a little bit like meeting Che Guevara. You know, part of you thinks, oh, I can't wait to meet him. Here's this hero, you know, this sort of military hero, this guerrilla genius. He really is a very, very impressive man. What I liked about him was, I mean, he really is a strategic genius. I mean, the Afghans were completely outnumbered by the Soviets, completely outgunned. With 3,000 men, Massoud kept the Soviets out of the Panjshir Valley, which was sort of his homeland in the center of Afghanistan. They attacked it 9 times, I think, with artillery and tanks and air force and 15,000 soldiers. With 3,000 men, he kept them out. That's very impressive, but it doesn't mean he's necessarily a particularly nice person. And what I really loved about him just was his very evident humanity. There's a lot of talk, of course, of the living conditions in the Taliban areas. Women have to, adulterers are stoned to death. Women have to wear veils. They can't leave the home without a male relative. Very, very harsh Islamic laws. There was none of that in evidence in Massoud's territory. And women worked. They didn't wear veils if they didn't want to. It was very open. For a traditional Muslim society, it was very, very open. And he, you know, in the evening he'd read poetry. You know, he just had a very sweet, sort of gentle side to him, which you don't very often see in a man who has fought for 20 years and who's that strong and tough as a person. It's a very rare combination.
Can you give us an idea of how he is in action, conducting his guerrilla war? You sat in on some of his strategy sessions with commanders in a bunker. Apparently, he works for 36 hours straight when he needs to.
Oh, he's I mean, he can sort of outlast everybody, as far as I could tell. I mean, I had the feeling his commanders by 3 in the morning were just begging him, you know, please let us go to sleep. He sat there with his commanders in a bunker. It was usually at night that they would launch the offensives, the attacks. And he'd be there under a kerosene lantern. You have to imagine the scene. You're under a kerosene lantern in this bunker, and you could hear the artillery going off around us. And he'd have an old Soviet map of the area and a little plastic protractor like a high school student might use. And he's just studying the map and calculating angles and measuring distances, and then, you know, continually on and off the radio to his commanders in the field who are leading these attacks on the ground at night, you know, in the night, you know, attacking these Taliban positions. And you go outside in the bunker and you just see this incredible light show. They were attacking a ridgeline. It was a couple of miles away, and we could see it very clearly. Just this incredible, weird, sort of eerie flashes of light and distant booms and thuds and all kinds of strange noises that battles make, that war makes. And another time, he wanted to really check out the ground that his men were going to attack over, because he was afraid that they would attack in the wrong way, in the wrong place, and, you know, get mowed down trying to charge these trenches. So we went with him into no man's land. We jumped into these jeeps, and we went tearing off into no man's land, and he went to the very, very forward positions, an incredibly dangerous place. He was just a few hundred yards away from the Taliban positions to check out every boulder, every little dip in the road. I mean, the terrain, you know, every foot of the terrain, because he didn't want his men, he didn't want his men to get killed needlessly. He was spotted up there, and a Taliban sniper shot at him. and the bullet hit between his feet, almost hit one commander and came to a stop in the dirt between his feet. Imagine General Schwarzkopf being in a position during the Gulf War to be killed by a sniper's bullet. It just would never happen. And I was tremendously impressed by that.
You observed Massoud organizing an offensive to cut off a Taliban supply road. And once this offensive began, Massoud was in communication with his forces on the radio, and you could hear those broadcasts. How did it go? Was the offensive an orderly progression or chaos?
You know, I don't think there's ever been an orderly offensive ever. You know, war is a very chaotic thing. His orders were not followed exactly. His commanders were not up on the front line with the men when they attacked, and as a result, they went through an area that they shouldn't have, and they went through a minefield and took a lot of casualties. And we saw the results of that immediately afterwards. We were in a field hospital when these guys were brought back. You know, so the fighting was just a mile away, and they were brought back at night in a flatbed truck, and it was really one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen. There were several offensives that we saw, and the first couple of ones, particularly, if you hear the calls come in from the men and from the commanders in the field, just these panicked. It's in Persian, so I can't repeat it. I didn't understand it. It was translated to me, but you know, begging for more. We need more ammunition. We need more ammunition, or stop. You know, stop your artillery fire. We've taken these Taliban positions, and now you're shooting at us. You know, you got to change the elevations of your guns. And, you know, just frantic. Sort of frantic calling back and forth, not as frantic as the Taliban, who were being defeated, who were losing their positions and retreating, and the panic in their voices was incredible. They were screaming back and forth to each other, just in real terror as their positions crumbled. And it was all, you know, we were in a bunker, and it was all happening through these radios, and you could hear it in their voices. It was all falling apart, and they didn't know what to do. Very, very powerful, very powerful scene.
You also describe how Massoud and his forces would take captured tanks and helicopters from the Taliban and kind of recycle them. They'd repaint them and parade them as new arms, make it look as though they're being supplied with help from another country. It seems he has a brilliant PR mind.
Yes, he sort of in the expression, he sort of thinks out of the box. You know, he they're always salvaging bits and pieces of tanks. I mean, they can build a tank out of anything. It's I saw some of the tanks that they were going to repair, and they're just these rusting hulks. You know, you wouldn't have no idea what to do with them, and he would put his mechanics to work, and they would fix these things up. During the Soviet times, they shot down a Russian helicopter. And some guy put wheels on it, put a truck transmission in it, and turned it into a bus and drove it around as a passenger bus around the Panjshir Valley. So they basically these Afghans can repair anything, and they can make anything. The electricity all in that area all comes from water wheels, homemade water wheels that hooked the truck to gear, you know, truck transmissions into generators, all homemade. One thing that really impressed me, there was a tank that was wedged between some houses and they couldn't get it out. The engine had died. They couldn't get it going. They couldn't get another tank in there to drag it out. It was basically sitting there stuck. No one could figure out how to get this thing out. And they told Massoud about this, and he said, well, buy the houses from whoever lives there, destroy the houses, and there's your tank. And no one had thought, you know, these houses are made of mud. And no one had thought of it. He paints these tanks new and purposefully shows them in places where the Taliban can see them so the Taliban will think, oh, my God, he's just gotten a new shipment of tanks from the Russians. Half of it's a mind game.
Sebastian Junger's profile of Afghan guerrilla leader Shah Ahmad Massoud appears in the current issue of National Geographic's Adventure magazine. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is journalist Sebastian Junger. He spent 5 weeks tracking the Afghan resistance leader, General Massoud. His journey is the subject of a National Geographic Explorer documentary on CNBC. General Massoud's territory is very small. It's described as only about 5% of Afghanistan. What is his objective in the war? Is it not to win, but to continue not to lose long enough that he outlasts the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, I should say that I'm not sure why it's always reported as 5%. I mean, we were there. We traveled. We were on a lot of the front lines, and it really is closer to, I would say, about 20% in the northeast. If you draw it out on a map, it's quite a large part of Afghanistan. The Taliban, this war would not be happening if the Taliban did not have massive support from Pakistan. And not only support, but direct involvement. I mean, we interviewed Pakistani prisoners of war in Massoud's prison camps, Pakistani soldiers fighting in Afghanistan, tank battalions, commandos, direct involvement, not indirect, direct involvement in the fighting. And I think eventually, you know, Pakistan is a poor country with a lot of problems. I think they thought the war would be over, that Massoud, who's outnumbered, would have been dislodged from his enclave, you know, years ago. And I think eventually they're going to have to make a choice. Do they continue pouring their resources, their men, their tanks, their generals into this fight that is unwinnable? Or do they pull out their support? If they do that, I don't think the Taliban have a chance of defeating Massoud. And I think they would have to negotiate for some kind of coalition government. That's the long answer. Yes, he's trying to outlast them. He's trying to outlast Pakistan's resources. And there's a tremendous amount of civil unrest under the Taliban regime. There are already uprisings and resurrections that they've had to put down with soldiers. I think eventually it's going to crack, and he's trying to last long enough to let that happen. And I think it will. This summer, I think, should be a very, very critical time over there.
Did you talk with Massoud about the support he's receiving both within the country and internationally?
Yes, I did, and also with his foreign minister, Dr. Abdullah, who was there as well. Internationally, he is supported by Russia, which, as I said, is ironic since he fought them for 10 years, but I think they are so worried about having the Taliban on their borders that they're choosing to support someone who had been their enemy for 10 years. And Iran also is supporting and sending in weapons to Massoud, and India. On the Taliban side, it's mainly Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Although I should say that in this prisoner of war camp, there were prisoners from all over the Islamic world, from the Philippines, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Algeria, even Chechnya. It has been sort of described by the Taliban as a jihad, you know, a fundamentalist Islamic movement, a fundamentalist fight to spread true Islam throughout Central Asia. And of course, there's differing opinions on what exactly true Islam is. A lot of people believe that the Taliban are not particularly practicing true Islam, just a very extreme version of it.
Could you help us understand why Iran would be supporting Massoud and his resistance forces? Seems more likely they would support the Taliban.
I think for Westerners, it's very difficult to understand all the politics and the sort of religious issues over there. That Iran and the Taliban are at odds for several reasons. One is that Afghanistan exports 70% of the world's opium. Most of it, or a lot of it, goes out across the border into Iran. And there's a real low-level war going on between Afghan drug runners and Iranian border patrol. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people killed it's basically a war. It's not even drug interdiction. It's basically a desert war. And Iran, just as a side note, Iran really feels quite underappreciated by the world for trying to stem this flow of drugs. and it is costing them a huge amount. They're also, there's a major division in Islam of Shia and Sunni, and the Taliban in Iran, Persia, fall on separate sides of that division. And frankly, I think the rivalry between Iran and Pakistan also plays a part. You know, the Pakistan is supporting the Taliban, which leaves Iran on the other side of the fence. I think a lot of things go into it.
Does Massoud have aspirations beyond fighting in politics?
No, as far as I can tell, he keeps insisting that he is. I mean, he's been offered political positions over and over. His friends have said, "Listen, you're the perfect leader for Afghanistan. You're more than just a general." He has had some sort of figurehead positions, but he has involved himself very, very little in the actual politics. And if you can take him at his word, what he says is, I want to win this war. I want to bring peace to Afghanistan. It's been 20 years now. I want to retire and read my books. I've got, you know, four children who I never get to see. They live in Dushanbe, Tajikistan. I want to bring them into the Panjshir Valley. I want to finish building my home there. I'm 50 years old and I'm exhausted. And I don't think he really wants to continue pouring his life into Afghanistan. He says he wants to teach a little bit. I think he feels he's sort of served his country well enough, and he wants it. He wants this phase to be over.
Massoud and his forces, though, have been cited in Human Rights Watch reports for committing war crimes, for perpetrating at least one massacre during the time between the Soviet war and the rise of the Taliban.
Yeah, the Northern Alliance. The opposition to the Taliban are called the Northern Alliance, and it is a very spotty collection of commanders. I mean, some of them actually fought for the Soviets and fought Massoud because they were in league with the Soviets, and now Massoud is sort of forced to be partners with them against the Taliban. So it's a very sort of, at times, unsavory alliance, and one of the worst atrocities happened in Mazar-e-Sharif. Under a different commander. Massoud really had nothing to do with it. But, of course, they're all part of the same group, and he's not... he's basically in bed with some very unsavory people. The one time that it was that I know of that where atrocities were committed by men directly under his command was the killing of several hundred ethnic Hazaras in a neighborhood of Kabul. And the Massoud is Tajik, and the Hazaras and the Tajiks have never gotten along very well. Just watching Massoud's treatment of prisoners, and of civilians for that matter, I find it very hard to believe that he would have, that he knew about this massacre. I mean, it's just not consistent with what I've seen of him in his territory. But it was his men, I never asked him about it, but that was that's my understanding of the situation.
Sebastian Junger's profile of General Massoud appears in the current edition of National Geographic's Adventure magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sebastian Junger is my guest. For a period of about 5 weeks, he shadowed the guerrilla military commander, General Ahmad Shah Massoud, leading the resistance forces against the Taliban in Afghanistan last November and December. When you traveled to the front lines of the fighting between the Taliban and the guerrilla forces, you had to cross a kind of no man's land. Could you describe that territory for us?
Yes, it was. We were in no man's land a couple of times, once with Massoud and once on our own. The more dramatic of the two times, we had to cross. We went up the front line towards the south to a little town whose name translated in Persian to Tulip Field is the name of the town, a very lovely name. We went down to the river. There's the Kukcha River goes through a very narrow gorge there, and we crossed on a raft. It's a design that must be 1,000 years old. It's cowskins, whole cowskins sewn together into these sort of balloons and inflated with air and then stoppered with a wood plug and tied to a wood frame and paddled across by these old Afghan guys. Just extraordinary thing. And we crossed over and we loaded up the TV gear on some horses and walked for hours out across the desert up into these sort of rolling hills, just stark, barren land up to the front line. Just as we got there, I don't know if the Taliban spotted us approaching or if this point of the front line was slated for an attack. I don't quite know what happened. It was a position that had just been taken from the Taliban 2 days earlier. Some of the guns were actually still pointing in the wrong direction, pointing towards Massoud's forces. They hadn't turned them around yet. Right as we got up there, a rocket barrage started, and very, very frightening. I'd never been caught in a barrage like that. Very, very frightening experience. We were crouched in these trenches while the hilltop just got peppered with these Russian-made rockets that the Taliban were shooting at us. And what made it worse is that we knew they were coming. The commander on the hilltop had a spotter on another hilltop who could see the Taliban position. And they'd fire these things off in groups of three, and the spotter would radio our hilltop saying, okay, they're coming. We had 10 seconds. That's how long it took for the rockets to hit. And the commander would shout, okay, everyone down, and everyone just disappear into their rabbit holes. And you'd be sitting there waiting, you know, one, two, three, you're sort of counting the seconds in your mind. And then you just hear these things come screaming in and hit the hilltop. And we sort of suffered through that for about 45 minutes. And then the commander found out we were going to get attacked, that the Taliban were going to attack on the ground. And he didn't know if he could hold that position, and he didn't want us there to find out. And so we had to run. You know, in a trench, you're really quite safe. However scary it is to get shelled, you're quite safe. You're not safe if you're above ground running, and which is what we had to do to get out of there. And one of the horses was killed, but we all made it out okay.
How much do you know about this kind of artillery? Was it going through your mind if a bomb landed a few yards from me, this is what would happen, or a few feet?
I don't know that much about artillery except that it's awfully loud, you know. And I mean, I knew that if you're flat on the ground or in a trench and it hits above you, you're pretty much safe. I mean, it sort of sprays outwards. And if you're really down in the dirt, it's quite hard to get hit. The hilltop was really getting peppered, and I just thought, God, if we're stuck here long enough, eventually these things are going to start dropping in our foxholes. Just statistically, eventually they're going to start doing that. And the terrifying thing is that you don't know is when you hear these things screaming towards you, if it does hit you, if it does drop into your little hole, you'll never know it. I mean, you'll just cease to exist. And that idea that I could somehow just stop existing and never know I was even killed, that was just tormenting to me. It really was this weird sort of existentialist experiment. You know, it's like, well, if I'm still thinking 3 seconds from now, I'll still be alive. And if I'm not, I won't know it. It's an awful thing. You really don't want to contemplate it for too long.
So when you're scared that badly, does the fear take a distinct form? Are you not able to breathe?
Let's see. How do you experience the fear? It's in your stomach. It's in your stomach. You get into a very selfish state of mind, and you know, where the kind of state of there's no heroics, you know. And if there's someone lying on top of you in a foxhole, your thought is good, because if a shell lands near us, he'll get killed, I won't. It's a very embarrassing thing to think. I mean, later, you could feel quite ashamed about it. But in that moment, shame, pride, all those things don't matter at all. You just want to get out of that alive. And, I think if I were with a dear friend, I would feel a little differently. But these are Afghans I didn't know, and they were being very sweet to us, very protective of us and everything. And you just think, if it's him or me, it's him. I'll pick him any without a second thought.
Sebastian Junger, Into the Forbidden Zone, a National Geographic Explorer documentary about Junger's journey into Afghanistan, airs this Friday night at 8 and Saturday at 11 on CNBC. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Get Happy, The Life of Judy Garland by Gerald Clark. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film, The Dish, tells a little-known story, how a small-town radio telescope facility in Australia was responsible for televising Neil Armstrong's moonwalk to the world. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director, Rob Sitch. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.